This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. A few days after American bombers began dropping their payloads on Iraq, writer Peter Maron began a dialogue with himself on paper. Everywhere the news was distressing, the faces of evil omnipresent. Saddam Hussein, he was sure, was an evil man inflicting horrible suffering on his neighbors and on his own people. But were Americans not falling into the same trap? He looked at the anti-war protests, and he wondered whether their shrill smugness was so very different either. Over the last few months, Maron has continued working out his moral dialogues. He's gone back to Gandhi, to Tolstoy, to Camus, to Martin Luther King Jr. The dilemma we all must face, he believes, is that there is no escape from tragedy. Welcome to Fresh Air, Peter Maron.
Thank you.
Is that the case? Tragedy confronts us wherever we turn? Whatever choice we make about war or peace, intervention or not?
Well, I'm not sure that I would use the word tragedy right off the bat. I think what concerned me about the war was the question of whether or not one could stake out a position equally critical of the Iraqi invasion and of our response to it. And what I found when I went back to look at the traditional pacifist and anarchist arguments on which I think a resistance to the war had to be based, I found that the really compelling and convincing arguments against war were made by those with a certainty based on religion, those who felt that God's words had directed them to resist violence and stand for peace and life so that they would feel comfortable. As comfortable as patriots who engage in war, they would feel that comfortable in resisting war.
Well, you say that in our national opposition to Hussein's aggression, in your writing, you say that in our national opposition to Hussein's aggression, that it is almost as though we've rediscovered our own submerged thirst for war. And, well, I suppose that now, in the aftermath of the war, it's almost as though we've taken a delight in that thirst for war.
Well, you see, that's the problem. I think what happens is there was provocation. There was the invasion of Kuwait. And then one began to wonder, each of us did, I'm sure, except for those who are blindly patriotic, about the appropriate response to such aggressive behavior. But then once that decision was taken, once we as a nation decided how to respond, then you saw growing in the citizens and in the politicians, I think almost across the board, a hysteria of patriotism and a sort of moral blindness, which became as disturbing, seen close up, as anything the Iraqis had done. Where this left you, I think, was with a revulsion at the Iraqi behavior, but with a similar revulsion at the behavior of one's own nation. And the problem which then offers itself is there a moral or a political place to stand in which you can speak against both sides, as different as they are, in the name of some third system or foundation of value? Indeed, I kept looking for that among the protests against the war, and sorrowfully couldn't find it, since the argument seemed to be rather tired, very shrill, somewhat hysterical and self-serving, but none of them seemed to be cutting to the very traditional heart of resistance to the nation-state, to the blindness of patriotism, and to war itself. Because what I feel is that the individual responses to the war, as powerful as they may have been for individual persons, never found the sort of compelling public eloquence or the kinds of rhetoric or convincing speech which would serve to convince others of the profound significance of the arguments being offered. I think what you see when you go back and look even as late as Randolph Bourne or Paul Goodman or Camus, you see a use of language which becomes almost in itself the alternative to the rhetoric and sloganeering of war. And the thing that I feel we've lacked in this country, and probably lacked even back in the 60s in that anti-war movement, were the kinds of sustained and profound arguments which might sway people who were already neutral or people who were disposed towards the war and then were convinced perhaps by something other than the violence of war itself that war might simply lead to more war rather than to peace.
Well, you in your writing, I mean, you seem to acknowledge that to have failed to confront Hussein over the invasion of Iraq would also have had tragic consequences. That there was that to be a pacifist is not to be an innocent.
No. I think religious pacifists can feel innocent because they are doing God's bidding. I think secular pacifists make a gamble. That is, had one not gone to war with Iraq, we know this would have cost Kuwaiti lives and probably Iraqi lives. That is, any position one took on moral or political grounds was likely to leave you with blood on your hands. The pacifist gamble is that in the long run, resisting evil with something other than violence will lead sooner rather than later to the cessation of violence and the diminishment of evil. Certainly, in spiritual terms, that makes a certain amount of sense, but I think it also makes sense in secular and historical terms. If you look at the history of wars from the 18th or 19th centuries on, you see that each massive war was an attempt to end war. Once you argue that you are becoming violent or waging war in order to establish peace, I think we have to understand in secular and historical terms that these are specious arguments and that war never leads to peace.
Well, certainly are those who have pointed out that with the apparent demise of the Cold War and the rise of regional wars, there have been more weapons sold and more people killed in something in the order of between 35 and 40 regional wars in the last decade than there were in any of the great conflagrations.
Well, you see, I think there's a basic question here, which is the one that interests me. Take a single person now, whatever their politics, whatever their ideology, who looks in each direction at the violence around them, looks at the behavior of the Iraqis, looks at the behavior of their own country, looks at the behavior of nation states in general, and now the sort of tribalism which has replaced in many places the nation state. If you look at this with a sort of clear or childhood eye, there is simply something insane or crazy about it. It makes no sense. It makes no sense to the individual heart, makes no sense to the individual conscience or soul. The question which then arises is there an appropriate response from an individual who finds the whole system which surrounds him or her insane and who can find nothing in it which corresponds to their moral imagination or what their soul whispers to them in the dark of the night about what's possible for humans or what would make a home in the world for flesh? I think that's the point at which you have to begin. You have to take a half step outside what seem like the imperatives of history and raise the question for yourself, if all of this seems crazy to me, what should I do about it, or where can I stand?
Well, you speak again of the lone man in Tiananmen Square facing down the tank of the Chinese Red Army, that it was a moment like that of seeing this man's flesh against the power of the state that moved much of the world.
Yes, I think it's precisely there that a secular morality begins. That was almost an ideogram for what it is I'm trying to describe here. We all saw on our screen the machines of war with their immense and obscene power, the power of authority, the power of the state, and the power of the machine itself, the power of technology, set over and against the pure, simple fact of the single living creature or the flesh itself. And how many among us would not, seeing that ideogram as it was acted out, side with the single living creature as opposed to the tank or the persons in the tank? We know almost instinctively, if not instinctively, which side one is to be on. So what happens if you begin to extend that? And now you have our bombers rather than the tanks, and you have the hundreds of thousands of young conscripted Iraqi soldiers, many of them simply teenagers, dug into their trenches, and the planes flying over and over and over again, destroying then those young men. It's not clear to me how different that is as an ideogram or an image or a fact of life or war from the tank and the single human creature. It seems to me if we begin with that single human creature, then some of us will decide that in every instance where power is arrayed against vulnerability, where machines are arrayed against flesh, where authority is arrayed against the single human soul, that we are duty-bound, not just through the spontaneity of our reaction, but through a morality thought through and hard won, to side with the creature, with the flesh, against the machine and against the state and against the powers of war.
My guest is Peter Maron. He's a writer, and he's been thinking a lot about war lately. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Peter Maron is my guest. He's a writer in Harper's Magazine and other places, currently a fellow of the Alicia Patterson Foundation. He's been working on a long piece about the search for a basis for morality and for pacifism in this country. You don't deny all violence, though. You don't, for example, you say, in your writing, you say you don't necessarily deny the occasional necessity of personal violence to combat evil.
Well, what I say in the piece actually is the fact that I would refuse, and indeed did refuse as a young man, to take the orders of my nation state in terms of who to kill or not kill, or when to go to war or when not to go to war. I can't say, though that kind of refusal comes easily to me, I can't say that leads me automatically to the position that I would never personally be violent to defend my family or my house or perhaps even my nation. I say two things in the piece. One is that the question of violence, like the question of good and evil, like the question of fidelity, like the question of honesty, is a lifelong individual struggle for each one of us. And the fact that one opposes violence in principle or has, in a sense, decided or taken an inward vow to try to deal with it or avoid it doesn't mean that one can predict one would avoid it at all times. Secondly, I say in the piece that I don't have any trouble understanding that two people of equally goodwill confront the question of violence in relation to politics and freedom and come up with different answers. Certainly, I'm quite able to have respect for a person on the other side who thinks through this issue clearly and carefully and then says, well, as much as I hate to say it, I think that violence here is the only way. This leads us right back to the question of tragedy. Because I think it's possible for the person who comes down on the side of nonviolence to say, I am fully aware that this refusal of violence, this refusal to go to war, may indeed have tragic consequences, not so much for me, but for other persons. And I think then that the person who comes down on the side of violence has to be able to say, well, I think I'm able to come down on the side of violence, but I understand that this too will have tragic consequences. I am not comfortable with anybody on either side who is absolutely certain of their position, and I am very comfortable with people on both sides who think through their position and then take a stance with a certain sense of terror at the fact that they have no way of knowing what the real consequences of their stance will be. In a certain sense, the people who have that sense of moral terror, the people who live with a sense of tragedy, no matter which side they're on, are in a way allies.
Because they know that they will all have dirty hands.
They know something about being human, which is that nobody is more pure than anybody else, and that all of us in the long run will do some good and some evil.
My guest has been Peter Maron. We've been talking about a work in progress on searching for the roots of morality in America and in the world. This is Fresh Air.